طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome to another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a committed group of his friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a decidedly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. This Week in Palestine is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is John Roberts. On today's show, we will be sharing with you an interview of American activist Brian Avery, conducted by Voice of Palestine's host, Hannah Kawas, which was conducted on September 15, 2014. Brian Avery is an International Solidarity Movement, ISM, activist who was shot in the face by Israeli troops back in 2003 while working with Palestinian communities to resist occupation and settler colonialism. In this interview, Brian talks about his experiences with ISM and the current situation in Palestine 21 years after the Oslo Accords. As a grassroots group dedicated to nonviolent action, ISM continues to work for justice in Palestine despite brutal conditions on the ground. Ironically, the state of Palestine once again recently proved that it is wholeheartedly committed to brutally killing Palestinians with impunity, whether their resistance is nonviolent or violent in nature, to, quote, honor International Human Rights Day on December 10th, Israel celebrated by killing Palestinian official and activist Zian Abu Ayn, who was also nonviolently protesting land confiscation in the West Bank. After being beaten and tear-gassed, Abu Ayn was murdered by Israeli occupation forces. To quote the Adamir press release on Abu Ayn's murder, quote, "The cold-blooded murder of Ziad Abu Ayn on International Human Rights Day is representative of the occupation's continuous and rampant destruction of Palestinian life and land since the establishment of Israel in 1948, which ironically coincides with the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. On this International Human Rights Day, the international community must realize that it is complicit with Israel's continued suppression, murder, and displacement of the Palestinian people until Israel is held accountable for its crime." Unquote. Here is the interview of Brian Avery by Hannah Kawas of the Voice of Palestine.
Welcome to another edition of the Voice of Palestine, Voice of the Palestinian People. It's September 15, 2014, and I'm your co-host, Hannah Kawas. This week we are talking with Brian Avery, an American social justice activist who was shot in the face by Israeli troops in April 2003. We will talk with Brian about his experiences, the role of the International Solidarity Movement, of which he was a member, as well as U.S. policy on Palestine and the current situation 21 years after the Oslo Accord. Good afternoon to you, Brian, and welcome to the Voice of Palestine.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's a distinct pleasure to be on. Your list of guests are very... company I very value very much, like Joshua Mazin Kapsaya, So it's a real pleasure to be on and to be considered in, you know, that kind of company.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your current health situation, because I'm sure many people are following on your situation from back home, even because they listen to us through the internet. Could you update us about your health situation and how you're doing and what you are doing now?
Yeah, sure. I'm sure most people who, or anybody who's familiar with the case, will know that, I was shot in the face by Israeli Defense Force officers, and it was very, very damaging injury and required a very extensive medical reconstruction effort. It took about 8 years. The last surgery was in 2010. These days, physically, the medical treatment is finished. I'm doing okay. I'm doing fine. I recently completed a master's degree in international relations in England. Right now, I am a practicing musician, looking to be full-time, and considering applying for doctoral work in international relations studies. So things are okay. Things are fine.
That's good to hear, really, and because I'm sure lots of your friends and comrades back home would love to hear that you're doing fine and you're back to normal, as normal as could be, you know.
It's interesting. I just got back from a trip to Chicago, where I lived briefly before I went to Palestine, and knew a lot of the social justice activists there and got to connect with some of them, and it was really nice. I think they were really sort of impressed that that it wasn't a totally devastating circumstance, that I've been able to sort of garner a very sort of fruitful professional life. So.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I want to take you back a bit to 2003. They murdered Rachel Corey on the
15th
of March, which is 20 days before, really, shot you.
Correct.
And, it looked like they were trying to intimidate volunteers and observers with the ISM, with the International Solidarity Movement. They were trying to scare them off from coming to Palestine. You think this is part of the reason, or they just brutality for the sake of brutality?
Well, I think there was already a sense that they did not like us there, that they did not like what we were doing there. They were very confrontational, very aggressive towards us, very nasty towards us. But I think I was in Nablus when the news came in that she had been killed. And it was a sense of, just deep loss. I had met her.
Yeah.
We both arrived in Palestine at the same time. And so it was very, to me it was a very personal loss. She was a very engaging young person.
Yeah.
And it was just, I think it was a signal that things were just starting to get worse, that they valued us as people increasingly less, and we're willing to engage in the same sort of retaliation that they typically reserved for the Palestinian population.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly after my shooting, and there was a few other shootings, Tom Herndel, James Miller, it just became quite obvious that they, the gloves were off, so to speak, and they just did not care. They did not fear that there would be enough of a international reaction to what they were doing, that they felt enough confidence that they could do whatever they wanted to do, to take those actions, those violent actions, and get away with it, without a scratch, so to speak. And they had, they did, and it's why things are still so horrible today, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think that's the sense of immunity that keeps them, killing and murdering, and the devastation they inflicted on Gaza is really enormous. Some people estimate the explosive power that they dropped on Gaza is as much as 16 times of the Hiroshima explosive power, which is really devastating. I mean, imagine 16 Hiroshima bombs dropped on a small area like Gaza. And this sense of immunity is really still going on, and nobody is challenging them, and they're getting the support of the U.S., the empire. How do you feel about U.S. support for Israel? And if you could tell us a bit about their role in trying to bring justice to you with the Israeli, especially the Israeli courts or the Israeli government.
I mean, I'll say that what happened in Gaza recently, I think it's part of a pattern of genocide by the Israeli government, to be quite bluntly honest. They've proven in the 11 years since I was there, they have, launched nothing but brutality against the Palestinian population in Gaza and the West Bank. You see what they did to Beirut and Lebanon. They just show no reserve whatsoever to destroy human life, however they see fit. And I think, unfortunately, part of the problem of that is that they are patronized by the United States government, which, to be quite honest, does not practice terribly different in their political relations in that part of the world. This government is no less, the American government is no less guilty of atrocity in the Middle East. It's been a pattern of hostility, certainly acutely since the Iranian Revolution, but sort of more dismissively in the classic colonial sense before that. The United States government has done nothing to cultivate good relations in the Middle East. How many students from American universities are studying, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia? How much cultural interaction is there? None. The U.S. government promotes none. Mm-hmm. All they promote is, sort of military sales and weaponry, sanctions. All there is hostility and aggression. And it makes for what is, the great tragedy that that region has been in recent times, how it's a constant conflict zone, of, very nasty, brutal government regimes, suppressing speech and dissent. And, we are, by and large, responsible for that in our political patronage of those regimes. So, how should Israel feel any discouraged from, using murder as a political tool of interaction when, they look up to their patron and see a little different in behavior? I think it has to start here. It's what got me and many others involved in the international solidarity movement and involved in supporting Palestinian rights. Because I am, as an American citizen, representative of that government. That government is my representative, and so I feel responsible for that.
And not just on the political level, really, Brian. It's also, the most probably the bullet that shot you was made in America. The same with all these devastation they inflicted on Gaza by American-made planes and weapons, and and then also, I'm sure you're aware that the Senate approved a bill to $226 million to replace all their ammunition that they used on Gaza the last war. So in a way, I believe many people, especially the Palestinian people, feel that the U.S. is complicit in these war crimes. What do you think?
Well, I think certainly so. I think that the U.S. government pursues certain economic interests. And, think about it. Think about a country like Iran, for example, a country surrounded with U.S. military bases. You know, imagine if there were Chinese military bases in Canada and Mexico, you know, down into South America. How would Americans feel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think people have to understand that there is other worldviews besides, you know, that of the United States. You know, I look at it on a human level. That's what, you know, bridged me into getting involved. It's a human issue, you know. Mm. All the other things, the borders, the identities, you know, you're this, you're that. That's our own fiction. That's our own creation. You know, no human being is inherently better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the Israeli regime, and I include the Palestinian Authority within that regime. I see no distinction. I see one total political regime. And I think it is a very racist mm-hmm. system, and it should be abolished. I think the Zionist regime that runs Israel needs to be dismantled.
Yeah.
And however you want to set up the resulting state, if you want to declare it the state of the United Nations, make it the seat of international political intercourse, you know, whatever you have to do to grant full political rights to everyone, I include the Palestinian right of return in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that regime, that political regime that says if you are not aligned with the Zionist regime, and especially within the context of their exploitation of the Judaic culture mm-hmm. and their exploitation of Jewishness
mm-hmm.
in terms of the discourse surrounding that political state, then if people can't sort of, you know, look beyond those artificial slogans and statements and delineations, then yet we're not going to break out of the pattern of violence we're in now. We're not going to have a, you know, just resolution, at least in the near future. And so, you know, there's no, you cannot tell me that my political opinion, you know, as many Zionist organizations like to do, that, for example, my opinion of that political situation is somehow less because maybe I'm not Jewish, I'm not this, I'm not that. It's absurd, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, when I talk about myself as a human being, a person, an American citizen,
mm-hmm.
It is still a human issue, and I think it's something that everybody should feel responsible for.
Yeah, and I think as long as the public opinion inside Israel support this kind of warmongering and racism, you know, it's going to continue, and it's going to continue because of the unconditional support they're getting from the West, the U.S., Canada, and to a large extent the European Union, the so-called European Union. So in a sense, they are empowering Israel, empowering Israeli supremacist ideology, and, you know, not giving incentive to the Israeli public to change their attitude.
Yeah, I think the complicity in the Israeli regime is certainly not reserved for the United States alone. I spent several of the past few years in England as a student and as a professional.
Mm-hmm.
I think that government, for example, is no less complicit in what's going on. Their record, I worked with an organization over there in a campaign against the arms trade and their research into the British government's role in weapon sales and agreements in the Middle East. Complicity in the Israeli regime is far and wide. And it comes out of, I think, a pattern of, you know, or a certain view of international law as simply a power and numbers game, that the U.S. is dominant and whoever sort of collaborates with them receives, you know, privilege. You know, you look at some of the former Soviet states, the relations they've had, you know, those regimes. You know, it's a very personal thing. It's people on a high level interacting with other people. Unfortunately, it's very tilted towards very rapacious economic concerns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do not think that these really Palestinian conflict is somehow in any way divorced from international political economy. You look at the Israeli economy and their sector in weapons and military sales
mm-hmm.
they have all over the world. I remember when I was there in the hospital in Haifa talking to local Israelis
mm-hmm.
about, you know, their view of that state and talking, you know, about the sort of corruption, how, you know, almost para-Zionist the government was in terms of, you know, for the example, the banking system almost operating as a black market version of Switzerland, just to keep the sort of machine going, if you will.
Yeah.
And so it's interlinked to a sort of larger political economy, but when you're in a position like a Barack Obama, a John Kerry is, as a preeminent public spokesperson for, you know, a state like the United States, then you have choices. You know, you can say certain things. You are not required. There's no gun to your head to say that you have to, you know, reinforce your support for the government of Israel. It is a choice these people make according to their view of world political order and the United States' role in it. It's a view I severely disagree with and severely, frankly, disapprove of.
Yeah.
And so, but there's a term of political science called public diplomacy, and I feel that it's a bit lacking in United States interactions in the world. You know, you think about a country like Afghanistan and that region. I mean, how many Americans do they ever see, have they ever seen in their life that did not have a gun in their hand? You know, that is not a special recipe for, you know, fruitful, you know, diplomacy and, you know, especially in terms of the larger sense of international relations, international diplomacy.
Yeah.
You know, the United Nations is pretty much a, you know, it's a figure piece. It's almost an academic institution. I feel it, you know, draws no real influence. I feel people like Ban Ki-moon are just yes men. You know, sort of, and it's just, it's a shambles. And, you know, people, there's no excuse. There's plenty of information out there, plenty of books, great books by people like Ali Avenida, Mazin Kaseya, that, you know, show that there are alternative views, you know, the works of Edward Said. I remember his, you know, reading his views and analysis of the Oslo Accords when I was in the hospital in Israel. And it resonated very, very much with me. And I think that is a great inspiration and influence. And I think, you know, I think Oslo is a joke, to be honest. I think it's simply entrenched the Zionist political system of policy in governing all of those territories, you know, from tip to tip, sea to sea. And you've seen just how, you know, I liken Israel to almost a Jewish Ku Klux Klan state. It is a very violently racist regime. If you are not, you know, and it's not just even the exploitation of Jewishness, it's the exploitation of sort of whiteness and white privilege. I mean, you know, how many black presidents of Israel have you seen? You have Jews from African nations who go to Israel and they're completed with complete contempt and disdain. So it's a very multi-layered sort of system of racial supremacism and sort of ethnic supremacism. And, you know, I think it could behoove most people to pay a bit more critical attention to that, you know, especially, you know, in the United States, given the legacy of African slavery and Jim Crow. You know, you can take the South African apartheid example, if you will. You know, those institutionalized racial regimes or racial discrimination regimes were, you know, at least in policy, dismantled. You know, they're sure there's still lingering sort of tensions, but in terms of, you know, a rights policy regime. So there's no excuse for anyone to say that that regime, the Israeli regime, cannot be dismantled, that it cannot be dismantled without, you know, catastrophe happening. It's you know, if you look at it on a human level as human beings who can, you know, coexist with full rights across the board for everybody, free movement for everybody, you know, to say that a, you know, de-Zionized Israel cannot work is to say that, you know, the abolishment of Jim Crow in America was a mistake because we did not have some sort of perfect, you know, society. It's disingenuous. And I think there's no argument by the Israeli government or their, you know, supporters far and wide, or should I say, you know, propagandists far and wide, that there cannot be a radical change in the political order in that territorial region.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, even if Jews don't agree with the Zionism, they end up being barred or censored, like what happened to Nahum Chomsky and Adam Shapiro. Now he's not allowed to even go back, and I'm sure you're aware of him. He is part of the International Solidarity Movement, or he's married to Huwaida Arraf, who really is a co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement. Now he's barred even from going.
I just think it's really sad. It's really a shame that you know, guys like that. I know Adam and Huwaida, and you know the things they have to deal with just because of their identity and who they are, and you know what their passport is, and what their you know how people view their heritage and their lineage. I think it's a disgusting shame.
Yeah, it is.
You know.
You know, I'd like to ask you about your experience with the International Solidarity Movement and how do you look at their work? And, you know, they still now do having a presence in Gaza and in the West Bank, including Hebron and other places. Could you tell us a bit about your experience with them, and do you recommend people to go and, you know, bear witness on the situation in Palestine?
I definitely keep up with the reports that people still send out, you know, under the umbrella of the International Solidarity Movement. I think they're, you know, there's never ceased to be people going over there doing good, you know, deeds, if you will, writing reports and, you know, making sure that people like me who are not in a position to travel to Israel, I was barred from Israel. You know, many people who are familiar with my legal cases against Israel will know that, you know, it took quite a bit of diplomacy to even allow me to enter the country to hear my hearings on my own case. So, you know, it's just, it's a bit of a shame, but people have gone over there and continue to do work. I think certainly, you know, I think it certainly never ceased to be dangerous work. That point was made clear when, you know, I was shot and others were shot. And so I commend people who have continued to try to report from there and to try to, you know, in the very least, maintain just human cultural relations with people who are unable to travel outside, who are literally locked in that ghetto. So, you know, I would 100% support anyone who wanted to travel to, you know, Nablus or Jenin and, you know, engage with the local community, to volunteer with the local community as we did. We volunteered with the hospitals and the medical teams. And so, you know, it's an important part of, you know, it's probably the most important part of conflict resolution. For individuals to take it on themselves, whether as citizens or as people, to whether in official or private capacity, to lead and show that one should not be afraid to be critical and to examine and investigate.
I'd like to also, you know, you've been in Jenin refugee camp. That was almost a year after all the devastation. I'm sure if you could talk about it, see what happened.
I mean, that was the real sort of sadness of it all, was that when I was there, it was the anniversary of that, what I would call a genocidal massacre there. And so people were very emotional about it. And the Israeli response was to come into the town, lock it down, patrol the streets, and fire into houses. And as ultimately was the case with me, fire on human beings. That is definitive of their style of diplomacy and their method and philosophy of political relations is murder and, you know, injury. And so it's, you know, it is a urgent situation. It never ceased to be an urgent situation. And I think every day that goes by that, you know, atrocities like Gaza are allowed to happen is just, you know, people should be ashamed. People should be ashamed that that is happening in our world. And, you know, the powers that be seem to be completely indifferent to from stopping it.
Yeah, and these outrageous acts are still continuing, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians continues. I want to also ask you specifically about the U.S. government reaction to your shooting by the Israelis, and did they rise to the occasion, and did anything really to demand that Israel do an investigation or Israel be accountable for what they did to you personally? Because, you know, we interviewed the parents of Rachel Corey many times on The Voice of Palestine, and it didn't seem that the establishment, the political establishment, is willing or was willing to challenge Israel for what they did to their daughter.
No, I don't think the American government is. I would just like to say hello to the Corys. They're very dear people to me, and it's disgraceful what they've had to go through and the treatment they've received from Israel. The American government, I think, with my case and these cases, I think they just view them as sort of, on one hand, a nuisance, and on another hand, just sort of a sort of cost of doing business. I think it's that blunt and that just sort of harshly insane. People like John Kerry and Barack Obama, on a personal level, they have somehow accepted that the destruction of human beings is a almost inherent necessity of being a part of the American and global political order these days, almost on a human level, as if it's inevitable, which I think is just, an ethical, joke. Yeah. And so, Israel, the people in the decision-making system in Israel, they are not, they're not so wild and unclever that they're not, aware. It's not like they went through and literally hunted down and massacred every single person that was associated with, say, the international solidarity movement. They are conscious of limits in international relations, and so, but it pays you cause to think that it's a fact that my father, for example, was a captain in the U.S. Navy. He served on fast attack nuclear submarine, and so when I was shot, when they tried to transport me to Israel for medical treatment, they refused me at the border and held the ambulance for several hours, and there were negotiations between the American ambassador and, his Israeli counterparts, and I'm sure that came into play. Say Barack Obama today, he doesn't, want to have to deal with that, but when it comes up, it's just sort of dismissed. The Israeli investigation was hardly an investigation. It was basically a sort of exoneration of themselves.
Yeah, it's a whitewash.
For what went on. And it's the same with Rachel Corey in every other case. My attorney, Michael Sard, and his counterpart who handled the civil case, Shlomo Becker, they have dealt for a long time, continue to deal with cases like these, and they are very candid in their views that the Israeli justice system is entirely corrupt and biased. The very fact that you even get a sort of trial or legal process as I did is a testament to, on one hand, citizenship, the fact that I was American, that Rachel Corey is American, and so those relations do allow for a certain bit of leg room, at least in terms of a pantomime legal process, as Israel does and continues to do. So it's, there is so little introspection in American media, even academia. I have a master's degree. I'm very, up to speed with sort of how the academic world works. Or in American discourse about Israeli society itself. You do not see many Israelis on TV, much less Israeli dissidents or Zionist dissidents talking about, the day-to-day politics and what goes on there. I mean, how often do you see a Palestinian on, national American TV, someone with, a viewpoint that does not, essentially conform with, say, that of Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. So it's just a giant paucity of critical analysis and debate on that political situation. Obviously the legacy of the American Congress and their almost, I would call it, zealous, overzealous, almost rabid support for the Israeli regime, as if it was almost somehow treasonous in America not to support that government. And I think that is just a very sad state of affairs, and one that it just shocks me that people do not turn their heads to and question.
And then even George Bush stupidly asked why people hate us, after all they did all over the world, and the bases and the suppression of the people through the supporting dictatorship and supporting Israel unconditionally. Then he turns around and he says stupidly, why people hate us, it's really, mind-boggling that it's not just the people, but even some of the, I don't know if he knows or not, but even a president claims he doesn't understand why people hate the U.S. empire. But having said that, I'd like to move a bit and get your opinion on what can people do to support the nonviolent struggle in Palestine, especially the BDS movement internationally.
I certainly support the BDS movement wholeheartedly. I always have. I was very proud to see that movement get going, from the ground up. I was very proud to be a part of that movement in various ways. I can't say I'm the most terribly active person in the Palestinian rights movement right now, but I do enjoy contact with many, many, many people who are doing, if not part-time, full-time work on that issue. There needs to be more. I remember after I came back to the U.S. after the shooting, I was able to travel around the country and talk to a lot of groups, go to a lot of communities and talk to a lot of people. I would encourage people to just, be more inquisitive, about that conflict. How do you reach the public? How do you get it out there? If the media has somehow decided that it's not something they want to deal with, it's a very arrogant, I think, and brazen approach that reflects, the U.S. government. I think it's a shame that the news media takes such a docile approach towards America, and even analyzing it in a sort of, what I would say is a political scientist, looking at America as a regime, as an empire, taking these, very deep analytical, sort of reflections on, the United States and the role in the world. I think it's a very systematic thing in the United States. I did a bachelor's and master's degree in political science and international relations. I think what's going on in American universities with the gutting of liberal arts programs, I think, is a completely counterproductive effort in terms of, providing people opportunities to be educated and to do research on alternative, analyses of, in Israel, a Palestine, an American government, an American regime in the Middle East. And, it leads to a very narrowing of opinion and a very sort of hawkish and sort of brutal narrowing of opinion. That's sort of the way political things are seen today. We still have a very Machiavellian system of, sort of self-service and just And so, you know, people should not be afraid to speak out. You know, people who go on the corner of their street and hold up a sign. You know, I remember very early on in sort of my, you know, conceptions of activism and politics of, you know, people during the Clinton administration's bombings of Iraq,
yeah,
and how they responded to those. And I felt very sort of, you know, inspired by their willingness to stand out and be,
yeah,
you know, if not a public hate figure, then certainly seen as a public sort of,
yeah,
you know, or somebody people would write off as kooks or something like that. You know, the American political dialogue and debate is very narrow in general. I think ever since the sort of quashing of the Nader presidential campaign in 2000, I think it has grown,
yeah,
you know, repulsively, you know, dichotomous and narrow.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from a few social issues like the gay rights movement and, you know, the women's sort of reproductive rights movement things that I think have highlighted just how backwards our political decision-making is in this country. You know, hopefully those can be sort of inspirations to people to think more critically and to,
yeah,
get more involved. The vote for Scottish independence is upcoming. I think it's this week. I'm not sure when. But there was an article that said that there was a 97% rate of people registering to vote. Virtually the entire country was taking part in that.
Mm-hmm.
I think people should take that as a, you know, an inspiration that, mm-hmm, you know, you should take a part, and that if you do take a part, you can literally decide, you know, your political order, you know, as they are doing there, whether they vote to split from the, you know, the British system. And so there's no political outcome that is not impossible.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the quote, unsolvable, you know, millennial, you know, Arab-Israeli conflict, I think that's such a horrid write-off of that conflict,
yeah,
to say, oh, it's been happening forever.
Yeah.
It has not. The Zionist movement is a recent, modern creation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can call it a century-old conflict if you want. That's a pretty valid analysis. But beyond that, it is a very short history and one that is just absolutely rife with poor decision-making that reflect a very sort of poor attitude towards, a very brutal attitude of human interaction that still continues today. The United States sort of campaign now against Iraq.
Yeah.
They're literally turning the entire region into a giant open war zone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not contained. It's not Afghanistan. Now they're literally launching war in the entire region.
Yeah.
And, you know, who's caught in the middle? Iran. You know, it's just, I think it's disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pathetic. And, you know, people, you know, no one should feel afraid to stand up and oppose that. I do not.
Sure. Yeah, I think also you mentioned Clinton and the peace process. Just a few days ago was the 21st anniversary of the Oslo Accord, where the U.S. was a signatory to it. And in it, basically, they pledged that the Palestinian state will be created in 5 years, with all the final status issues will be resolved. That's 1998. And here we are, 2014, and none of the basic issues. So Clinton's signature was worth the paper, wasn't worth the paper it was signed on, really. And, you know, the U.S. continues with not, you know, honoring their commitments to the peace process or to the human rights in general of the Palestinian and the Arab people, and they still try to intervene. But, you know, I think we talked quite a bit about that. If you have a final word, you know, to our listeners, and more specifically to the people you know back home in Palestine, if you want to send them a message about how you've been doing and what's your message to them?
Yeah, it's just, it's a bit painful, you know, to think back to all the people I knew and to wonder, you know, to have to wonder in such stark terms, you know, who's still alive, who's still in good health. You know, I felt very welcomed and very, you know, made to be a part of the family, so to speak, in that community. And I still feel that way, and I still feel that way when I do interact with, you know, Palestinians in America. And I'm very grateful and very sort of humbled and honored, you know, to be considered, you know, a respected member of their community. And so, you know, we all pray and hope that, you know, that news will come tomorrow, that, you know, the accord has been reached and it's all been solved, and, you know, help me if I can live long enough to see that, that, you know, would be, you know, a fantastic, you know, realization in life. But, you know, there is obviously work to be done. You know, more people need to do more work. You know, for me, I'm, you know, most people know me as a, you know, political activist or this and that, but I'm also a musician, for example, and aiming to be, you know, a full-time musician within the music industry, you know, and I'm very conscious of the, you know, the cultural boycott.
Yeah.
You know, I would, you know, if I joined, you know, a musical project, which at the moment I'm currently preparing to do, with a very sort of, you know, commercially successful group of music artists, then I would not hesitate to tell them or anybody else that I would refuse to play a concert in Israel. I support every artist like Coldplay and Roger Waters who have, you know, risked, you know, substantial sort of capital in their professional life to stand in solidarity with Palestine and the BDS movement. And, you know, I would certainly, you know, any position I could be given that would allow me to, you know, promote and influence, you know, better resolution to that, I welcome and hope to, you know, throughout my life, you know, until that day comes, to help, you know, in every way I can.
Yeah, and it's really encouraging, Brian, that more and more people, musicians and intellectuals, are aware of the BDS movement, and it's growing in leaps and bounds, so it's great to see that. Again, you know, I think we touched on most issues. If you want to say anything else, you're welcome, but it was really a pleasure talking to you, Brian, and it was also good to hear that you are doing fine.
It was certainly a pleasure for me to be on here. I very much enjoy talking. You know, some people might think I might be a bit reticent to, you know, talk about these experiences, and I might want to put them behind me. But that's not the attitude I hold. I'm very, you know, happy and honored when I get a chance to, you know, discuss these issues. And, you know, just, you know, it was pretty much a miracle that I even survived that shooting.
Yes.
And all due credit to the surgeons in both Israel and the United States for putting me back together, so to speak, as much as they have, and allowing me to, you know, continue to live and continue to, you know, participate in, you know, hopefully world affairs, and you know, hope to continue to do so for many a day to come. So I appreciate, thank you very much for bringing me on today.
Yeah, thank you very much, and we'll stay in touch, and have a good afternoon.
That was an interview of American activist Brian Avery from the International Solidarity Movement, conducted by Hannah Kawas of the Voice of Palestine. This concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment of Truth and Justice Radio, aired every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. on WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. We hope you join us again next week for news and views from and about Palestine.